Okay. You're recording.
Okay. Thank you all. I recently read an op-ed piece in the LA Times about bad introductions. And so I almost hesitate to say this, but the two women we have here today almost need no introductions, but I'm not going to say that. Melody Johnson Howe, this is your first book, right? Yeah. I remember Melody when she came to Sisters in Crime to speak, and I just recall how exotic and beautiful she was, and she'd written this wonderful book, which I have, incidentally. Please. And Tom will give you some details about her early days, which I, of course, am too polite to say, but anyway, so this is her first novel, and I actually read this when it first came out, and this was the one that was the Edgar won, right?
No, alas, it didn't. And the woman that
it should have won. You were cheated. No, it was nominated for an Edgar for first best.
Yeah,
a whole bunch of Anthony Agatha.
And all of the Ed things. So, and this was followed up by a second novel in the series. She's written short stories. She's done everything. And we're so happy to have her here. Would you like to introduce Gail?
Sure.
Yeah, I think you should introduce Gail because you're really going to be in charge of this. But, of course, Gail, I think we all know Gail. And there are a few short stories I was going to tell you about her early years and some things that happened. But, I'll let Melody do that. And by the way, we're recording this because we actually put it on our website for all the people, the shut-ins, who couldn't be here today.
You don't have to hold it close.
But you can if you want. So
okay.
Please welcome our two wonderful guests. All right, well, I'm introducing Gail. She is referred to as a kick-ass writer by one of the bigger newspapers. I'm going to ask her what that really means. She's been a major writer for quite a few years. She is one of the first women thriller writers to really break through. And she has created a major, the ITW.
Author organization.
Yes, thank you. Words fail me. Author organization, International Thriller Writers, much to the chagrin of NWA, but we won't get into that, darling. And she is not only a wonderful writer, but a very giving writer, especially to other writers, and I think which is very important. Anyway, so Gail, my darling. Now, I have promptly lost all my notes and my pad. I
again.
Oh, well.
Oh, yay.
Oh, God. But I don't really need them. I'm going to
just put this down somewhere. Like down there. Right over here. Yeah.
Here, why don't I move over?
There you go.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, baby.
I love it when Melody's in charge because I don't have to do anything. She's really good.
Oh, yeah, where's my note? So, Gail, what does a kick-ass writer mean?
You want to see the dance in my butt.
I know. With your toes.
Yeah. That was the London Observer. And what they said was I was a kick-ass thriller writer. And I still don't know what it means, but I loved it so much because it
means
slightly...
It means...
Oh, see, she's going to say, I told you I love it when she's in charge. I don't know what it means, Melody. It means tough. You know, I'm really, really good about making sure the garbage goes out on the right day. And I write in a genre that all of you, I'm sure, are aware is something of a tough genre.
And male oriented.
It is perceived that way, yes, in New York publishing, and still to this day, alas, it is certainly perceived that way. But the reality is, of course, is all people of both sexes and various races and sexual persuasions and so forth read these books. And it was a genre that I had loved for a long time. I have a very strong political bent. And I was looking for a vehicle that I could talk about that in without driving people crazy. I could entertain. I could help people to maybe pass some hours with some enjoyment. I have this theory about reading books. I really think people read books not just to be entertained, but because they really want to learn something. But they don't want to shove it down their throats. So thrillers to me were a very big canvas, a canvas that I could have a lot of different color on. I could do a lot of different things. And as long as people were having a very good time, I could get away with it. So that's basically why I write thrillers.
Now, when you started, first you were an obit writer, which I love. You wrote about dead people. Now, that involves research, right? Right? So is that where your love, your sort of getting good at doing research came from? No.
I think I'm basically a nerd. I really do love to learn stuff. And in fact, Melody, hold this a second. Let me get this stuff here. I don't know about you, but I always am curious. I'm always asking my friends, including Melody, how they write. You know, how do they write? How do they put a book together? I'm going to turn this around here. Okay. So I thought, in case you all can see, that says the CIA. I thought maybe you might like, I might bring some show and tell, so you could see a little bit about what I do and how I do it. My books are research intense, in the sense that when you finish reading one of my books, I really want you to feel as if you've been there. You know what it's like. You've lived a life. And you've lived it not just in the technology or in the politics, but in what happens to people. What kind of person is attracted to this kind of life, what it does to them, what it's like for them on the other side, what their journey is like. Now, that means that from my perspective, that I have an obligation to really pay attention to the details. So I just wanted to show you a few things. The new book that I'm working on right now, I'm about a third of the way through, is called The Book of Spies. And it does involve Islam, and it involves history, which is much ancient history, which is unusual for me. But I've been carrying around a clipping since 1989 that I knew I wanted to write about. I see a head nodding, so I'm not the only one that does. I know a lot of you do this. You carry clippings around that mean an awful lot to you. You don't know if you'll ever get to use it. But it's always in the back of your mind, and you're looking for the right vehicle to use it with. So I finally came up with an idea that I could use it with, and that's the Book of Spies. So that is going to be part of it. But I wanted to show you. This is a book on Islam, obviously. But look at the little yellow tabs. And if you open it up, you're going to see endless highlighted lines, paragraphs, etc. Look at this. And if you go into my library, you're going to see book after book like this, with yellow tabs marking passages that I'm never going to use. But for some reason they struck me, and frankly, I don't remember them. However, I do trust my unconscious, as all of us can do. Even though it may not be readily accessible, it may not be RAM memory, it's in there someplace, and it has an influence on you. One of our jobs as writers is to become authorities. Now, we're not true authorities. I'm not really a botanist. I'm not really a PhD historian. I never really was a field agent. However, if we are very, very good at what we do in terms of interviewing people and doing the research, after a while, we have the voice of authority. And we're good enough, if we don't push too far, that we can give the reader a very strong sense of place and identity and what it's like to live a particular kind of life. Another thing that I do that might interest you, I hoard these box tops. As you can see, this one actually came from Amazon, and I whacked it off, but I also used the lids of boxes of printer paper, and I have 20 of these on my shelves behind my desk. And this one is loaded with printouts, clippings, notes, ideas, everything and anything, so that when I want a general overview of a particular subject. This, in this case, it's the CIA. I have one on Russia. I actually have one on the old Soviet Union. I have one on the KGB. I have one on military technology of various kinds. I have one on future book ideas. I know what my next two books are going to be, so they share a box. So the notes go in there, the clippings go in there, and then, you know, I forget most of the stuff that I'm throwing in there. But for some reason, something has struck me, and I'm sure all of you have experienced it. Something strikes you. You don't know why, but there's something in there that might be useful to you in the future. In any case, you do want to remind yourself of it. So I have 20 of these boxes behind my desk. In addition to them, I also have a wall full of research books there. Those are my most readily accessible research books. And again, their history, their politics, their intelligence agencies, their armaments, all kinds of odds and ends that I use much more regularly, almanacs. And then across my office on other walls are many more research books that I don't use as frequently. Next to my desk are three boxes of these with file folders in them. I have about 100 file folders, and this is for just this one book, just this book, mind you. And each of those file folders has clippings, notes, and ideas in them that service this particular book. So when I'm writing a book, I become inadvertently, I had no idea writers did this. Writers sat down and they started typing and magic happened. I didn't know.
Well, some of us do.
For me, the magic happens because I'm feeding myself. I'm feeding myself all of the time. And it's not just what I'm reading, but it's also, I go to movies. I go to a lot of movies, and right now I'm going through this Netflix period. Aha, you guys do this too. So you know how important it can be. I've been watching all the old Jean Le Carré, Mel and I talk about this, all the old Jean Le Carré movies. There were a couple of Frederick Forsythes. I went through, I love MI6, which is called Spooks in Great Britain. I went through all of those. Oh, yeah, it was MI5. Sorry, you're correct. She's always correcting me. She's right, too.
And I don't research.
And I watch television news a lot, too. And I watch television news analysis because that's the kind of book that I write. I have been called a kick-ass thriller writer, and I am competing at a very, very high level in the sense that I'm competing with a lot of people who have worked in the field one way or another and have very, very big sales, very, very big publisher pushes behind them. And it the speed of what one must run to stay in that field, that foot race, is very fast. But you know something, it's a lot of fun. I really, really love it. And Melody, you should tell them about your research or lack thereof.
Because
that'll be interesting. No, but it's fascinating. Because Dennis, my husband, my darling husband Dennis, who died a couple of years ago, was very much like Melody in terms of research.
Well, actually, research, we write totally different books. I'm a true mystery writer. She's a thriller writer. And we do read each other's works, which is interesting for critiquing each other. Was I supposed to say that? My research is limited. I do the same thing. I'll run across something that leaps out at me, cut it out, put it in a box, and 20 years later I'll go, what is this? You know, I mean, I don't, alas, always use it. But my research consists of driving down to L.A. and driving around L.A. to see what's changed, to what exists now, so, you know, that kind of research. So, really, it's totally different than what she does. Gail, you may not have been in the CIA business, but you were part of a military think tank. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
It was a lot of fun. I'm actually, I began life as a newspaper reporter, as Melody was telling you, and my degree's in journalism and sociology from Iowa, the University of Iowa. Now, you probably know that the fabulous Writers Workshop is there. When I was growing up in Iowa, a little town in Iowa, I grew up in a household that revered books. I was very, very lucky. When my mother and my grandmother would go down to the grocery store and the bank or florist, they would come back home, and they would come home with stories. Then they would sit around the kitchen table and drink coffee and tell each other stories about their day. And I was a very shy, introverted child, and I was just sitting in the corner listening to these remarkable women talk over coffee, telling stories. And I think a lot of my storytelling urges came from that. And then there were the books. And I did. I loved books. I had this, several of you probably had the same experience. We had an Andrew Carnegie library, thank you, Andrew Carnegie, in Council Bluffs, Iowa, and I lived there. And I had to get special dispensation from the head librarian so I could read in the adult stacks. It was major. I mean, it took a full week, and they called my mother. But I would carry stacks of books home to read constantly. And when I was growing up, I knew no living writers. I really did think that all writers were dead. Or they were gods and goddesses. It was not something that I could ever aspire to. So I went to college and I got my degree in journalism. And I had decided I was going to be a great journalist. In those days, journalist was an effete term. If you were real and you were serious, you were a reporter. And but I really, all I wanted to do was write books, novels. And but so I went to work. One of my first jobs was at the Arizona Republic in Phoenix. And I was a general assignment reporter. It was really interesting, and I did a good job. But I discovered some things about myself. It really was very difficult for me to expose people's pain, personal pain, on the pages of a newspaper. And I would be covering stories that were very rough. They were important stories, and they needed to be covered. And those people who were directly involved needed to be written about. But there was collateral damage there. There were the family members who had nothing to do with it. Yet their names were in the paper, they were being interviewed, and they were being hurt. And this is personally painful to me. And I began to see that maybe I didn't have what it took to be a reporter of the kind that really that newspapers wanted. And then there was an incident where I wanted to go. There were some riots in downtown Phoenix, and I wanted to go cover them because, after all, you know, that's my job. And so I went after the city editor and said, "Why aren't I being sent out? I'm looking at the newsroom. All the guys are gone. You know, what's wrong with me?" And he would not let me go because that was a girl didn't do that kind of thing. It was dangerous, et cetera, et cetera. So to punish me for even asking, he put me on obituary desk. Mm-hmm. And in those days, I don't know if it's still true, but that was the ultimate punishment. You were sent to the obituary desk. And God, it was horrible. I tried to like it. I really, really did try to like it. But it was just dreadful. And so what I did was, there was a new guy who came on, a new hire, straight out of college too. I was straight out of college. And so in those days, we would drink our lunch, margaritas and tacos. And so I took him out to lunch. I brought him a lot of margaritas, and I explained if he really wanted to make it in the business, he really had to experience all of the bountiful opportunities of a newsroom. And it's too bad he couldn't have obit desk, because I had that plum assignment. By the time that lunch was over, he was drunk and he really wanted my job, and we went back and I talked the city editor into giving it to me, and they did send me out as a consequence. I think the city editor was just worn down by me by that point. And I did get to go and cover the riots, and I did a good job, and I felt like the city editor had done his job and I had done my job, and I wanted out of the business at that point.
So how did that get you to the military?
My next job. My then husband was an attorney, and we moved to Santa Barbara from Phoenix. And so I didn't want to go back to a newspaper. I'd sort of had it with newspapers, so I wanted to do something different. When I was in college, Kurt Vonnegut was a visiting professor at the Writers' Workshop, and he was teaching the lit class that I was in. I didn't mention that. It was one of the things that I did when I was in college, was I was always sneaking into the writer's workshop classes. I got so that they thought that I was a student.
Iowa, right?
Yeah, an undergrad. And he was a guest lecturer at one of my lit classes, and I asked him about Cat's Cradle. I don't know if you guys remember Cat's Cradle.
Yeah.
I loved it. It was a fascinating book. And I said, where did you get that remarkable idea of, you know, the twist on the Midas touch? And for those of you who don't know, of course, Midas, King Midas touched something and turned to gold. Well, in his book, I can't remember who the character is now, touched something and turned to ice. Isn't that delicious? The imagination behind that, it's just gripping. So he said that he had gone to work, as all writers do. We have to have our day jobs, right? Our gigs. So he was always taking gigs because he had a family to support. And he wasn't making money off his books. So he went to work at a think tank, at a defense think tank. It was a privately owned defense think tank. And while he was working there, it was just so full of ideas that he found it a very fertile atmosphere. And that's where that idea came from. So when we moved to Santa Barbara, and I was looking, I needed a job. So I went to an employment agency and asked if they had any kind of think tanks around. I didn't know what a think tank was. As it turned out, Santa Barbara was full of that sort of thing. And I did get a job at a privately owned think tank that did a lot of military work. And that's where I, for the first time, was introduced to the dark and gray world of espionage. And there were very interesting shadowy figures who came through. And whenever I walked into the building, all of us had to have our name tags, you know, with our identification. And the poor guards. And I was so hopeless. Because I'd forget mine half the time. And in those days, they just sort of wave you through and then you get reprimanded. And then if you went from room to room, you had to, you know, punch in numbers and all this stuff. The idea for my first book came out of that. And it started me on this path of fascination with the world of secrets. Every family has secrets. And it's always the 800-pound gorilla that sits in the middle of the living room. Well, governments, of course, are like that, too. And governments must have secrets. But some of the secrets they don't really need to have. There's tremendous power in that, in making that decision about what we're going to keep to ourselves and what we're going to tell the public. And that, all of that sort of fed into my natural interest in politics. So that is basically how I ended up writing what I do today. But tell them about what you write.
About you, darling.
No, because she was an actress. She did fabulous, very interesting movies, including Clint Eastwood, whom she could tell what you said about Clint Eastwood and his kissing.
Oh, I spent 2 weeks with Clint Eastwood in bed and in the bath, and I came home to my husband, and it was a love scene for 2 weeks almost, and I came home to my husband, and I said, I'm sorry, but this guy can't act. He's never going to make it. So much for my research. Gail, to change the subject a little bit, you write wonderful male characters. And I actually fell in love with one of your male characters, Asher. And Tice, what's his name, honey?
Jay Tice.
Is an older, this is in your last book.
The Last Spy.
Is this wonderful old spy. And but still sexy and just a great guy. And how do you write these great male characters? I mean, they're not wimpy, they're not politically correct, they're not the new male, you know, the urban male, whatever that is.
I'm a hopeless heterosexual. I like men. I never really thought about it, Melody. That's a tough question. I don't know. I have this theory about writers. One of our jobs, men must write really good female characters. Women must write really good male characters. Because one of our jobs as artists, and we are artists, is that we are supposed to be and try to be androgynous when it comes to our art. We are, one of our, I think, the charges that we give ourselves is to be able to look at the world through other people's eyes. with not to, you know, in terms of espionage, mirroring means, and it's a very damaging thing to do, is when a country looks at another country and assumes that other country is looking at events the same way that the original country is. That leads to all kinds of problems. For an artist to really be able to represent the world, reflect the world, and comment on the world and tell entertaining stories that are accurate to the world and touch people's hearts and minds, there is incumbent upon us an ability to look at that world through the eyes of other characters, no matter what their sex is. To a certain extent, I limit myself because there are things I know I can't. Well, I have to back up. Years ago, I was in a writer's workshop where this lesson was driven home to me, taught by a man who said he would never, ever write a scene from the viewpoint of a female character. And I asked him why. And he said, because I don't like to shop.
What a guy. What a writer.
Mind you, this man was like a one-book wonder.
Thank God.
We were saved on that one, folks. But he continued to teach forever.
I mean, say that to Flaubert, for God's sake.
Yeah. I mean, it was appalling. And I made up my mind that there, of course, I was never going to be like that because he didn't get it, you know, and he was never going to get it. And meanwhile, he's chasing every young, attractive woman there and scoring quite frequently. And I'm going, I'm living in the wrong place.
See, he did like to shop.
Yeah. And take his purchases home. I really identify with people who are active in trying to do things. I would never write as a main character. I would never write a black person as a main character or another cultural, different culture from my own. Or I wouldn't write a gay person. I might attempt Jewish person. I have attempted a Catholic person. I think I've been successful with them. But I limit myself because I do know that I cannot be all things.
That's interesting. What, you know, because I, you know, you do in your books have many various kinds of characters, and whether you know it or not, you really have a continuing theme of the father-daughter relationship in your books.
Ad nauseum.
Yeah, which is, you know, which is interesting because even in Sorry Darling, for the condensation. I'll be all right there for a moment. But even in thrillers, you know, I mean, there are themes that run through these books, and the theme obviously has nothing to do with the thriller plot, but it's there, and you do it so well. You want to talk about that a little bit?
You have to talk about my father.
Your obsessions.
My obsessions? Oh, golly.
This is what writers do. We do all that. You know, they just keep popping up in different ways.
I was looking at my books the other day, and I was realizing one of my major themes is redemption and salvation. Redemption and salvation. You know, people who really screw up badly. Really screw up badly. And then they come back. And they try to make things right. And to a certain extent, they succeed. And they sort of save their souls. But I never say that in the books, you know. It's just sort of there. And I do have issues with fathers. Because I had a dear father. And now I look back on it, I realize that he probably had some sort of autism. And he maybe had Asperger's, which I believe I was the first person to write about. I created an ongoing character in the Covert One series that I wrote about. Anyway, the man never talked to me, bottom line. Everything was through my mother. And then when my mother died and left him on my hands because I was an only child, it was like he was forced to talk to me. And he had Alzheimer's, so he was a lot nicer. So, I'm sorry, Dad. He didn't mean to be the way he was. I don't think he actually could help it. But as of course, as I'm growing up, I'm not being charitable. All I'm seeing is the impact on me that I didn't have this male figure in my life. And I suppose I have been trying to recapture and figure that out all of these years. But you know, doggone it, there's that marvelous saying that no writer had a happy childhood. And if you had a happy childhood, you're not going to be much of a writer. So, thank you, Dad.
Now, you were talking about research, but you, in your books, you take us from one city to another, from one foreign country to another, and I know a lot of these places you haven't been. And
I mean,
you know, and it's one thing, I mean, I do have to share a story. We had gone to the, where were we? The Ojai?
The Oaks.
Oh, the Oaks. Terrible food. I hated it.
I loved it.
So starving.
And I have so much to eat.
God, she's losing weight and I'm gaining it. Anyway, so we're going to the Ojai.
You know, spa. The Oaks. The Oaks.
Oh, the Oaks. Okay. Oh, God.
I mean, I liked it.
Oh, God. Little plastic cups of things. Jeez.
I love
you. Oh, anyway, so, you know, we go back to our room at night, and I'd be in my bed reading, and she would be in bed with a pile of magazines going, rip, rip. And I feel like I should be doing something. I'm turning a page. I was just reading a book and enjoying it, you know. Anyway, okay.
I forgot that.
So, Gail, foreign countries, you really do capture them, but yet you don't go there. You know, so how do you do that? I mean, men, you know. I mean, I can understand, even though, you know. You know. But looking at a map doesn't always get it.
I'm not going to touch that one. One of my secrets is AAA. I always suggest to every writer that you join AAA. It's the cheapest research vehicle around. I get my maps, my books and stuff like that from AAA. And I have traveled a certain amount in England and in France and now in Greece. But I have not been to the other places that I write about. But I do intensive research, and one of my walls of books is nothing but research on foreign countries, including maps and guidebooks, personal accounts. Oh, my God. I mean, probably be less expensive and less time-consuming just to fly over there and do it. But I spend so much time on the road anyway. It's so nice to be home and not have to go someplace. I also talk to people who've been there. I think the most important thing that you can do when you're writing description is, first of all, it must be earned. It's not something that I've seen people just stick in description because they know they got to do it, and that doesn't work.
And it reads like it.
And it reads like it. Description is really should be revelation. It should be through the eyes of someone so that when they're describing the place, they're not only describing what they're looking at, they are subtly giving hints about themselves and who they are as a person. For instance, if you have this forest out there with the sunlight, well, one person is going to look at that forest and see the streaming lights, the straws of light, and be like fairyland and beautiful and lovely, woodland, gorgeous, etc. Another person is going to look at that same scene and they're going to see how eerie it is and how weird and shadowy and forbidding. So that's characterization. Same forest, same sunlight, same trees. That's the difference. And that's what I try to do when I'm writing about the various cities. And I do. I write about Geneva. I write about Brussels, Bratislava, Moscow, St. Petersburg, just, you know, all kinds of places.
So what you're saying, Gail, is that the writer's imagination, once you get the reality
right.
of the kernel of reality, then you can almost do anything as long as you've got the logic of the city. That it's
what you said.
What I said. Okay. One more question, then should we open it up to Q&A? Okay. After 9/11, you know, obviously the world turned upside down, and there was a moment there where everybody was running around saying, "Oh God, nobody's going to read books anymore. What are we going to write about? What are we?" And suddenly, up pops thrillers again. And you really were in the doldrums before 9/11. What happened?
Yeah, what was that like? It was hell. It really was.
You were before.
Yeah, because, and I'm so stupid. I go through my whole life doing things because I didn't know I wasn't supposed to. And the corollary to that is, don't tell me what I can't do, because if you tell me that, I'm going to go do it. You know, these patterns we see in our lives. So, when I was finally able to reach the point where I could write books that were my books that I you know I wanted my name on that I cared about was in the early to mid 90s, and really what I wanted to write were international political thrillers, and of course that meant espionage too. And, of course, the wall went down in 89. 91 was when the big coup happened in Moscow and Yeltsin took over. The Cold War was over. And publishing declared espionage thrillers as dead as the Cold War. The New York Times stopped publishing its, I can't remember now whether it was a monthly or weekly column.
Newgate Calendar, wasn't it?
It was Spies and Thrillers. Yeah. Spies and Thrillers, I think, was the name of his review column. That was gone. You couldn't sell anything in New York. So what am I writing? I didn't know any better. I didn't know I wasn't supposed to do it. Because I really didn't think it was over. It was just different. And espionage is really the second oldest profession. People have been gossiping and spying on each other forever. And it ain't going to go away. We always spy on our friends. Our friends spy on us. So when the book went to New York, I think some of you have already heard this story, so please forgive me. My agent sent it to the head of the publishing at Dutton, and whose assistant said she wants to buy it, but she's sick, she's got a cold today, she'll call you in the morning with an offer, a really nice offer. So my agent's totally set up, he calls me, I'm jumping up and down because I'm nearly broke, you know, I mean, it's time, I got to publish a book, you know, yada, yada. So he calls me the next morning, his voice sounds like death warmed over, I think, oh my God, you know, somebody bombed New York? Well, thank God, no, but I can't remember her name right now. She had called him that morning and said, I love this book, Henry, but no woman could have written it. And so, see, I forgot that part, too, that I wasn't supposed to do it. So he turned around and sold it to Steve Rubin, who was the head of Doubleday. And that was how my career got launched. But it was very tough going in the 90s because of the fact that that espionage thrillers were not, where there was no real belief of them in the industry. But still, the mass market of that book did hit the New York Times list. So go figure. You know, I mean, it was just weird. Because I think, honestly, putting marketing aside, what really matters is a romping good story. That's what people want. And they don't care if it's a cozy. They don't care if it's a detective story. They don't care if it's a spy novel. They don't care. They want a damn good story. And that's what our jobs are, to provide that damn good story. Now, of course, with 9/11, everything reversed. In the 90s, all my photojournalist friends who were used to tromping around the globe couldn't get a gig. They couldn't, you know, they were out of work. If you looked at newspapers and television and radio news, nobody was covering international news. We had gone into a cocoon. We were exhausted from the Cold War. 9/11 happened. We sat up. We looked around. We said, oh, my God, we don't know what's going on in the world. All of a sudden, my friends were getting jobs again. The headlines were full of international news. And now you open the front page of every newspaper has major news stories about what's happening in the world. Well, obviously, yeah, of course they do. But that's how much has changed. And so espionage, political thrillers are really taking off again. And it's fun for me to see, but you'll notice, or maybe you won't notice, I notice because I'm in this end of the business, but New York Times Book Review still doesn't review us.
No, they don't.
Interesting.
They hardly review anybody.
Yeah.
They're so elite.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't...
Relevant.
And furthermore, do you think we should open it up for Q&A, though? Okay, so are there any questions? Yeah.
Can you say something about your collaboration with Robert Ludlum? Could you repeat the question?
Sure. She asked if Gail could talk about her collaboration with Robert Ludlum.
That was the Covert One series that I had mentioned earlier. When Bob had been with Bantam for years and years, and and he was getting tired. His wife died. He got remarried. He wanted to reawaken his career again. So his agent took him away from Bantam and moved him over to St. Martin's. And at the same time, he wanted to do something he'd never done before, which was to create a series. Deliberately. the Bourne series was an inadvertent series. He'd not planned it to be. And one day I got a call and asking if I would be interested in collaborating with Bob. As it turned out, I had been called in the early years the female Robert Ludlum. And he apparently heard about that and had been reading my books and admired them, which, of course, is tremendously flattering. So I thought about it for a while because I, you know, I didn't know what that meant in terms of, you know, what this is going to do to my career, because I didn't want to slow down. But I eventually, of course, agreed to do it because I had, particularly his first six books, I tremendously admired. I don't think people realize the great contribution he made to that end of the mystery suspense field. He really, it had always been the province of the Brits, but he really made spy thrillers an American field. And he did very daring things that caused him a lot of trouble. For one thing, he wrote in one book, he wrote about, I can't remember which one now, the CIA spying in the United States. Now, you may or may not know this, but it is illegal for the CIA to do that. His publishers threw a fit. They wanted to pull that out, and he refused to do it. Book was published, and within the next year, I think it was the church hearings. Yeah, I'm not sure anymore. I think it was the church hearings came out in which it was exposed that the CIA had been spying in the United States. So he did quite a few things that were cutting edge in terms of the field and daring, and I really respected him. So this was an opportunity to work with him. So I was quite grateful.
And any other questions? Come on, guys.
Yes, sir.
How have you found it? That, you know, Have you found that your voice, your style has changed?
I think what you're asking is, have I had to compromise?
No,
I think he's really asking how, you mean over the arc of time, kind
yeah.
of? Yeah, how, if your voice and style has changed.
Yes, it has. But I think that's a natural outgrowth, and I was going to do that anyway. I'm so glad it's you and not me. Man, I was standing up to give this talk. I had like 500 people in the audience, and a cell phone rings, and I look around. And I realize, oh my God, it's me. Yeah. And his wife is calling me, right? But this is true, and it does happen to authors that they are asked to compromise and they are asked to change to become more quote commercial unquote. That has not happened to me at all. I've been very fortunate. I'm still basically I'm writing my own books. What I see happening is because I am, there's a lot of pressure on me to produce a book a year, and I know a lot of you guys are producing a book a year. I've not been able to because of my personal life, because of, you know, Dennis being sick for so long and so forth. And now I'm back at that stage where they want a book a year again. So what I'm finding is that I am consciously trying to simplify the process of not only writing, but working out my plots, my outlines, so that I can find more efficient ways of doing things. I think, to me, writing is tremendously hard work. And I'm seeing some nodding heads, so you know it is. It's a lot of hard work. That doesn't mean it's not full of joy, but it is hard work. And I'm very much in favor of trying to figure out ways that I can do it better. I think it's very hard for us to take breaks. Was that Diane Emily I was talking about? No, was it you, Paul, that we were talking about that? Where it's really important to stop and regenerate. I was just emailing with Tess. Oh, it was you, Patty. I was talking to Tess Gerritsen not long ago, and she was saying that she is creatively exhausted. You get drained, and yet we're so concerned about keeping up with the speed of publishing that we're in that kind of, on that treadmill. It's hard to get off. And it's also fear because, you know, the more you do it and your numbers get better, thank God the appreciation of fans gets better. You don't want to disappoint people. And, you know, publishing houses invest money in us. So our editors, if we don't turn that book in, they're hurt. Because those numbers that our editors are looking at that are dependent on us, his job or her job their next pay raise is dependent on us. And then the publishing house's bottom line is also dependent on us. We all are part of a very big industry, but that we can stand back and say, well, I'm just a small part, I don't matter. The truth is we do matter, particularly to our editors. So, yeah, I am watching myself try to do it better, more efficiently, while still maintaining a high quality. It's tough. I don't have any answers for it. I think it's every individual thing.
But I think it's also finding your style and your voice, which is probably the hardest thing for new writers, and sticking to it without having editors tell you, you know, change this, this voice doesn't work. You know, you really have to know in yourself if that voice works or not, and that's probably the hardest thing.
I agree.
You know, but the most important thing.
Yes, with that foundation, you can do a lot.
Yeah.
If you don't have that foundation, you're just endlessly screwed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. Endlessly screwed.
And it won't be fun.
It's an interesting observation. Anybody else? Yes. Yes? Go.
Nobody else?
No.
I read something that you wrote in, I think it was that you said you wrote short stories.
She's asking about Dennis, and he wrote short stories within his novels. Yes, he did. His last few books all incorporated short stories, and it was fascinating the stuff that he did. You know, he really changed the detective genre twice, 20 years apart. He was back in the 60s. A lot of people, including Don Westlake, had walked away from the field saying there was nothing more to be said in detective fiction. And that's, yeah, I know it sounds bizarre, but it was true. I've been in the field so long now, and this is kind of fun. I've seen things come and go. Yeah, and things that seem new to new people. I'm looking at it and thinking, oh man, that was 30 years ago. So Dennis, so he when he created Dan Fortune, he created a new way of approaching the detective novel that reinvigorated the field and helped to keep it alive. And then I think it was in the late 80s and early 90s when he started this new form, because Dennis had also been a literary writer. In fact, some of his short stories appeared in Best American Short Stories. He was an award-winning literary short story writer and had published two literary novels, too. So he incorporated short stories. He wrote multiple viewpoint. He wrote things. He wrote second-person viewpoint. He used other literary techniques that are now considered sort of normal and not nearly daring. But when he was doing it, he was being killed by the mystery viewers, many of them, not all of them. Dick Lochte said, you know, here's Dennis, and my God, the man has so much courage, he's moving into the next century. But a lot of mystery viewers didn't see that, and he did get killed for it. But
a lot of editors.
Yeah, the editors didn't see it either. But, you know, like Bob Cray, a lot of the guys that are writing today owe what they're doing as cutting edge to Dennis because he did it first. So try Castrato. Try Cadillac Cowboy. The Irishman's Horse. Those three would have the short stories incorporated. And you'll see a lot of other literary techniques in them. And they're damn good detective novels at the same time. See, this is what's so cool about what we do. Tell that really, really good story, and you get away with a lot.
That's true. Anybody else? No?
Stock in the Post-it note company?
She asked.
I buy at Costco. Reams of it.
All right. Well, thank you, you guys. It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gail.
I want to thank all of you so much. I'm just thrilled that you made it.